Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is the day after the elections, and the world is astir. I mean, it doesn't seem logical, but here in Westchester, we've had an avalanche of new results that were totally unexpected, I think, by every pundit out there except a few. Well, today is Wednesday, June 26, 10 o'clock on Eastern Seaboard, and the person that's going to be able to help us figure this stuff out is none other than Lorraine Lopez. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning, Westchester. Hezzy, I love you. You know,
you
stood
too.
There with us from the beginning. You stood there with us, and you were a great supporter, man. You know, we appreciate you so much.
Well, you know, it was very, very compelling, and you know, Tasha was did a very good job in the beginning. It was not so good, but she kept on getting better and better as we were doing interviews, and so there was a tremendous amount of growth and understanding on her part, and that bodes very well. What was most interesting is you and I spoke about this yesterday. We realized that there was such an outpouring of interest in the legislative district, number 17, where Jose Alvarado was slugging it out with Jose and
Lucy Moreno Casanova.
And Lucy Moreno Casanova. Lucy, I didn't hear from at all. I don't know where she was or what she did out there, but she got a credible vote, you know, and London totally flopped. And interestingly enough, though, what was more important is that all the candidates running in that district were of Hispanic background. And
yes.
People who had Hispanic background came out and were interested in that vote. And I think there was some residual after effect, when they voted for the legislative district, they also voted for the overlap of District 3, where Tasha was running. So it showed to me more than ever before that the demographic interest and the concern of the Hispanic community is no longer to sit back and watch and shut up, as they've been told for years. They decided to take control of this situation, and they're going to be now a power for the rest of history, and certainly in Yonkers. Don't you think?
Yeah, not only the Hispanic community, but the Jordanian community as well.
Well, the Jordanian community is coming up, but they don't have as much clout yet because of the numbers.
Mm. They really came out for Tasha. They really came out for Tasha, I'm telling you. Mm-hmm. They really did.
Mm-hmm.
They really did.
No,
but you're right.
Because
you and I have been talking about this for the last several weeks about the demographics changing in Yonkers. And and now history was made. She's the first minority sitting in that seat. And the history of Yonkers.
Absolutely. Well, she should be able to do well in that seat, and that'll become, you know, a Hispanic seat, just like District 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's very, very compelling for sure, and very, very interesting. And what about the other contests? For example, the mayor. There was the mayor. He was running for a third term. There was a lot of back talk, you know, below the radar screen. People were offended that he was running for a third term, but he got the support of all the city council members who voted for a third term to be an extension. And and he did very well. He won like 71% of the ballots.
You know, because Mayor Spano has an incredible machine, and we've known this for decades already, that he has an incredible machine. At the end of the day, he's got a lot of support, and like people like the Hispanic community, he has reached out to, And he reached out to them prior to him saying, I'm going to run again. Like when the Hispanic community would go to him with something, he would consider it. And you know, as a matter of fact, congratulations to my brother, Hector Lopez, who he just put into the Yonkers Zoning Board.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really reached out to the Hispanic community. The Mexican community especially is up new and upcoming. And he mm-hmm. worked very hard with them, and they all love and support him. I hope that coming into this next term of his, he realizes that he couldn't have done it without the Hispanic community, and you know, and I hope he doesn't forget that. You know, because
in your experience, what?
You don't think he will?
I don't think he's going to forget that he. I don't think he's going to forget.
I don't think he will either. I just hope he doesn't. I just hope that, you know.
All right, so you're afraid that he might? You're afraid that he might?
I'm not so sure. I'm cautiously optimistic. Let me put
okay.
it that way.
Okay, that's not a problem. I've seen him in the last few months, if not before. Certainly hasn't been going on for years, but I know that Corazon Pineda, who's in the 2nd District, her sister just got a job working at in City Hall.
Yeah,
that's
why?
Unnecessary, other than to buy off a support from the council member. So
mm-hmm.
it's prudent for him, as far as he's concerned, to get this vote. And there are others that you know he wanted to get support from, and who are Hispanic, and so he's filling up a lot of positions that normally he wouldn't have considered before. So I guess what we're
yeah.
saying is basically that the demeanor, the attitude, the interests of the city are moving from what they were, however you want to define that, to greater concern for the minority, which is really the majority of people in the city of Yonkers. So it's changing
yeah.
now.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? The tide has turned, and
yeah.
Mayor Spano has rode the wave with us. He absolutely has. He absolutely has. And we're very grateful to him, and we thank him. We're very grateful for being acknowledged and for him saying, I can't do this without you guys. And, you know, and not only that, but also how do I put this? He was open-minded enough to allow that to come into him. So he was open-minded enough to say, you know what, the demographics are changing. Latinos have done so much for the community. Latinos are not going away. You know, they are my people too. And, you know, it's my responsibility as mayor to take care of them as well. Whereas in the past, you know, that people have just ignored them completely. And I give him a lot of kudos for that. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Democratic Party was certainly not all that welcoming. I remember there were many candidates of Hispanic background who were simply told to sit down and shut up and wait their turn. So, and
you know,
I'm aware of for 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw Tommy Meyer last night. He showed up at Tasha's.
Uh-huh.
Victory party. And
yeah.
I went up to him. I shook his hand. You know, the look in his
yeah.
face, he looked at me like, don't come to me, Lorraine. And I just had to say it. I
Good.
Said, thank you. I said, thank you for not supporting my niece, but thank you for being here. And then I walked away from him because he's not worth my time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know how it is.
I know. So that's the thing that's really interesting, actually, when we come to think about it. The demeanor of the chairman, the Democratic Party chairman, which is Tommy Meyer,
Yeah.
Did he have an epiphany? Did he have a change in attitude somewhere between the announcement of the candidates and prior to the election? Because I think that there were a lot of people who were supported initially by the administration who were no longer supported by the administration as we got closer to the election process. Do you see that happening or not?
Yeah, I saw it happen with Dennis Robinson.
Oh, absolutely. That was very interesting because they endorsed him. They endorsed him initially, and then they dropped him like a hot potato. So
they endorsed him initially, then they badmouthed Tasha. And they let everybody who will listen that she's not going to win. And when they saw that Tasha was picking up steam, then, he never came out and supported her. He never came to any of her fundraisers or anything like that. He never called on regular, never did any of that stuff to reach out to her. But my God, I lost my train of thought. Yeah.
Okay, but the point is, though, that Tasha was able to win. And then I guess, but I think that reluctantly, Tommy Meyer decided to come on board. Or he may have been even forced to show up and congratulate her campaign effort because it was a very, very powerful win. That's the other thing, too. I'm trying to think the other big contest, of course, was between Terrence Miller, who was endorsed by the Democrats, even though he was not the incumbent. And it turns out Shanae Williams, who's in the first district, they were both black. But it turns out that Shanae got 57% of the vote. Terrence only got 43% of the vote. And interesting, Terrence supposedly was worked for Andrea Stewart Cousins. So her legs or her apron strings didn't help. And then on top of that,
I don't think it had anything to Andrea Stewart Cousins. I think it had a lot to do with Christopher Johnson.
Christopher Johnson
the one trying to pull the string. It was Christopher Johnson's loss. That was his candidate.
I know it was Christopher Johnson's loss, but he worked for Andrea Stewart Cousins as he studied under her when she was in office. And the bottom line is, she didn't say, I'm not supporting him. She was supporting him as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, everyone should take responsibility for what they've done. You know, just because nobody talks about it all that much doesn't mean nobody's like, I'm not in the business to scuttle everybody's story and tell them where it's at. But the point is, it's after the fact and people voted how they wanted for whatever reasons. And I'm not there to convince them to vote differently. It's not my job. My job is only to tell them what it is that I know, but not the games that are being played, because I know what was going on all the time. But, the point is, it's not for me to intrude,
Oh, my God. You know who lost?
It's not because
go ahead.
It's not because I want to deny people knowing. It's up to the candidates to say it the way it is. And in Yonkers, they're so timid, they're so afraid to tell you the truth of what the opposition is doing, they say nothing. And then that's why they sound like a bunch of nitwits who don't have a clue between their ears of what it is they're talking about because they never put it out there. And the point is, that's what we need to hear. That's the political difference of being informed, and we didn't inform the public. I don't think you can even say by any of the candidates inform the public of what it is that they're doing. I can't decipher that. Can you?
Any of the candidates that just won?
Any of them. All of them.
I have to disagree with you because Tasha has been in the forefront from day one with my media team.
What did she say?
Oh, come on. I'm not going to go. I'm not going to. You know what she said because you've been her supporter from day one, too.
I've been supporting.
She said She loved her community. She's been out there for them. Enough is enough. The change has got to come. The demographics are changing. She said, I have been out there. She has been out there. She has.
Well, that's what I asked you. And you get offended.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know,
okay, All right.
It's not a challenge. It's a question of responding to a regular question. Dennis has proven that he's not interested in the community, whether it's the north, the south, or the middle of that district, because it goes from the Bronx border all the way up to Hastings. So the thing is, he didn't respond to anybody, and he didn't even go out there canvassing. He didn't
you know
go door to door.
You know why?
Yeah,
because
lazy.
He thought. No, and because he thought he was going to win, because he thought that the north side was going to carry him, you know. And he, listen, if you look at his signs, they were a slap in the face to everybody too, because they were green and white Irish. So he was trying to tell the people, let's stick together. He's from the old regime, the good old boys club that needed to have a seat. And you know what? Thank God he had a seat last night. He needs to sit down, stay home, and get over it. No, but I heard he's doing a writing campaign.
He could do a write-in campaign. That's why I suggested what I suggested to you earlier. That's why it's important to stay in that mode for anybody who's being challenged after it's all been done. He set this up as a full as a backstop in case he should lose, and that's what he did. So the point is, that's why it's important to keep up the effort so that people continue to know more and more about these candidates, even though they've won. But what's interesting, too, is, and when you look at this, Ola Sebomi McCauley, for example, she came in third, and after Tasha, after Dennis, and she only got 18% of the vote, which was very interesting because she was supported by the Indivisibles. These are the progressive Democrats.
They were the biggest losers of the night. The Indivisibles were losers of the night. None of the candidates won.
That's exactly right. So that's the point. And interestingly enough, is that indicative of just Yonkers, or is that indicative of what's happening with the Indivisibles? Because, again, I suggest that they haven't given us ideas. They may have nice words to say, well, they're interested about this and the other, but they don't show us how to translate what they want done by a method that works. That's what they haven't explained. So just nice words that mean absolutely nothing, because you need to have an example of how it's going to work. So,
but let me tell you something. They're not about the people. They're about their own group. What, you know, what are you going to do for the Indivisibles? What are you going to, you know?
I don't disagree, Lorraine, but you also have to admit that everybody is in it for themselves in one way or the other. Some people
at the end of the day, you're right.
I mean, it's all about the job. It's all about the power. It's all about the money. That's for everybody. However, there are people that excel and can step up beyond that. And they do a phenomenal job in response to the community. And they don't forget that they really are servants to the district and the community they serve, and not the other way around. So there are some exceptional politicians out there that are to be applauded for the work that they do. And others, take them or leave them, they don't matter.
You know, one of those exceptional politicians is Mike Spano. One of those exceptional, really. I'm just like so happy right now that he's the sitting mayor of the city of Yonkers, and the city's going to be all right. City's going to be all right, at least for the next 4 years.
Okay. Well, you never know. They could always get another extension for 4 years.
Oh, hell no.
Why? Why you want to?
Because everybody needs to take. Everybody need no. Because you know why? Because at the end of the day, I want Mike Cater to be mayor.
Oh, I see. So we're saving the position for Mike Cater. How sweet.
Oh, no. No, absolutely not.
I can't stand it.
I think Mike Cater is going to excel the way he has been. There's no way no way to look at it but up for Mike Cater. No way to look for at it but up. Yeah. He's an amazing, amazing politician, amazing individual.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, you know, that's cool. So in other words, we're already suggesting before the mayor goes into his third term that Mike Cater is going to be the next mayor. So you heard it here first, and Lorraine Lopez, she's giving us a scoop on the show. Well, thank you, Lorraine Lopez. I had no idea. This is good stuff. You know, we should talk more often, Lorraine.
Oh my God, you're killing me, Eddie. You're killing me.
Well, I just love you to pieces. I mean, I just can't stand it. It's so revealing. This is cool. So,
by the way, you did an amazing job at People Before Politics on Sunday.
Oh, I love that.
Oh my God, it was so great to have you.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It really was. I thank you for inviting me. That was very nice. And you know, I think, what else can we say about the contests here in Yonkers? The Mascherano win was expected, but that's but again, not because the others were deficient in any way, but because simply because Mike Spano is very, very well liked. I mean, you can't overlook that. He's a likable man.
And he delivers.
People
and he
love
actually
him.
Delivers. He delivers.
Yeah.
When he gives you his word, that's one thing. When he gives you his word, he follows through. He follows through.
Absolutely. And so we have that. That's the reality there. Beltran was amazing because she had absolutely nothing going on, and yet she pulled in 17% of the vote. And Ivy was just a setup, I don't know, to try to divide between Black and Hispanic. But Karen Beltran did very well. Do you think that Karen might consider running again in 4 years?
First of all, I'm very proud of Karen Beltran as a Latina woman. I'm very proud to see her up there and step up to the plate and do what she did. It's something that I can tell my granddaughter, look at this woman. She was the first Latina to ever run for mayor in Yonkers. That's something that the Hispanic community should be very proud of. I hope that she stays on, but you know how it is, Hezzy, especially first-timers, when they lose, they get a little disillusioned, and then they don't participate as much as they should. You know, I hope she stays in the game. I really do hope she does.
It would be good, even if I don't know, in case you're right, you probably are, that Mike Cater is going to be the next mayor after this four-year term with Mike Spano. But you never know. Maybe Karen might be interested in it as well. Or she may want to even consider running for a different office as well. So there are different options.
Yeah, like county legislature.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting as well. Yeah, and that comes up in 2 years' time. Jose, though, did very, very well. Were you surprised by that? Because I was surprised at how poorly London did.
I wasn't surprised about how well Alvarado did. I was surprised.
Yeah, I wasn't
how poor, but I was surprised about how poorly London did. That took me by surprise because, I mean, he worked hard. He had a good team. I mean,
remember he went to the Freedom Fountain over at City Hall, had a press conference there, and his wife was there to, you know, just to warn people who were supposedly, she was suggesting that were undermining her family, her and her family and her husband, and they were casting all sorts of bad things about them. And but I thought it was all forgotten what happened in his past, and I don't know why they brought it up. I thought that that was a mistake for them to bring up something that happened a year and a half before. I thought it was all forgotten. I think that was what hurt him at the end.
Do you think, or you don't?
I agree with you
because I feel he got a little paranoid. I feel that nobody was talking about it. And he's the one that brought it up. Why are you gonna why not let sleeping dogs lie? Why are you gonna wake up this dinosaur? And these were pretty bad allegations that even if nobody didn't hear about it, now they're curious. I think he did himself in. You know, I got a call right after the press conference, and somebody said, "Yo, he just gave the race to Jose Alvarado."
Yeah, I thought so too at the time.
And that was the feeling of a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah, because they didn't exactly say what it is they wanted people to stop doing, but. That was the question. So everybody had a question in their mind. Well, what did he do? And that never came out. So I think the curiosity carried much further than it should have. Even if he brought it up, it would have been smart if he would have brought up the issue. But, you know, there's no reason to bring up the issue now and nor before. That was for the other candidates to bring up if they wanted to. Then one last thing about Lucy Moreno Casanova. Why didn't we see more of her?
Because the only real support that she got from an organization or whatever was from the Indivisibles. The Indivisibles. And they started out, hurrah, 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 and then they slowly, the fire burnt out, it seems.
Uh-huh.
You know, but
yeah,
I got
to
tell you,
Lucy.
Yeah, Lucy's been a great friend of mine for over 25 years. She's an amazing person, amazing community organizer, amazing activist and stuff like that. I mean, this was a trial run for her. I'm proud that she did it. I'm very proud of her. I was with her yesterday for a while, and I told her how proud I was of her. Very proud of her that she made the choice, you know. But Lucy's one of those people that's going to get back to work and keep doing what she's been doing in the community, not let her loss phase her. And, you know, she's just going to continue to be Lucy.
No, that's cool. So, again, this is another race in which the Indivisibles failed, a candidate that they initially supported. And also, interestingly enough, with Ola Sabomi, the Indivisibles were backing her. And they did a tremendous job in giving her support. I was just astounded that they just left. You know, they made a lot of noise in the beginning, and it turns out there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just blown away. You know, I don't understand what these games are for.
But let me tell you something. Sabomi lost because Sabomi. Sabomi lost because of herself. I know it's past and everything, but let me tell you something. She's rude.
Yeah.
She's crude. She's obnoxious. She felt entitled. Really? She was a bully. My God, that describes me. But you know what? She was horrible. Horrible. And she deserved that loss. And hopefully it'll humble her a little bit.
Well, you know, look, she's definitely humbled by the results, that's for sure. But so, you know, what it tells me, based on what you're saying about her character, then why is it that the Indivisibles were backing her? Which shows that, therefore, the Indivisibles made a mistake by backing her.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the reason they eventually left. But
no, I think,
you know,
I think something happened. I think they saw a part of Sabomi that they didn't see in the beginning. You know, I think they kind of woke up or something. I don't know what the situation was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
There was dissolution somewhere along the way. Very
interesting. There you go.
You said it perfectly.
You said it perfectly. Thank you.
Well, you gave me an insight. So that was very good. Well, Lorraine Lopez, how wonderful. It's always been a pleasure to speak to you, and I think you did a phenomenal job in letting us understand exactly what happened on the scene. There'll be more to discuss as we move forward and see how things work. So you think
thank you for your support.
Down and enjoy the summer? You think we're going to all just, it'll be quiet, we'll be able to have a good summer, and then we'll come back in November and vote again?
And that's interesting because this is the first time we've got a, what, 5-6 month period?
Yeah.
Like, who knows what's going to happen in between now and then? You know, I'm curious to find out because it's never happened. We're riding this for the first time.
That's true. Well, listen, let me get going. I've got to say goodbye to you because we've got our next guest on. So all the best, Lorraine. Be well.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Love you. Oh,
bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Let's pull in Sean Patterson Howard. Hello, Ms. Howard. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you? How's it going?
I'm doing good, but you should be probably exuberant and because you had a very, very tough fight, and evidently you've come out on top. So very, very exciting, actually.
Well, we're excited.
Were you surprised?
We're excited. Look, Hezzy, we got a lot of good feedback from the community as we knocked on doors, as we made phone calls, as we did, you know, meet and greets. But you never, ever know for sure how the vote is going to be pulled out. And so we're pleased and proud and very excited for the results. We know that Mayor Thomas is not going to back down, and he's going to ask for a recount, and so we're preparing ourselves for that. But we're also preparing ourselves for the future of Mount Vernon and are having the conversations that we need to start having about how we're going to move forward and not only prepare for November, but more importantly also prepare for January. So we still remain optimistic. We believe that the numbers will hold. But we are not ignorant of the fact that a challenge will be launched.
Well, it is interesting because I have heard rumors that Richard Thomas is going to try to do an independent run, a write-in, because he doesn't have any other endorsement. I guess it's conceivable he might even is one even permitted to create their own party and run under that, even though it's never been done before. I'm not sure if that's done. And then also Andre Wallace, even though he came in fourth of all the four people that were running, he's got the Republican designation.
Exactly.
So he accepted that. And so he's probably going to run as a Republican. But is anyone going to go and vote with a Republican in a Democratic city?
Well, that's why I said, you know, we're also getting ready for November. We know that we're going to have to deal with the challenge from Thomas. We know that Andre is going to run on the Republican line in November.
Right.
So there's still a fight ahead, but we're focused. And like I said, we've always been focused on the solutions and not necessarily worrying about the challenges. And so we're focused. I've already had conference calls with my team this morning, and I've had some, you know, really good calls from some of our leaders across the state. And we're excited about the support that we're getting, and we look forward to working with all of our government partners and our partners in all of the various sectors.
Well, that's actually very, very compelling. So actually this even though the elections were conducted in the primary, there's a lot of work to do over the next 6 months in anticipation of taking office. And then also at the same time, you know, Richard Thomas, the present mayor, he's going to court. I think it's on the 8th of July. He may never come out. You know, so he's going to be embroiled in all sorts of legal issues as well. And I think that today or within days, lawsuits are going to be coming down the pike because there's money owed to different law firms to the tune of almost $2 million. So, I mean, it's amazing how anyone in their right mind – I'm surprised that he even got as many votes as he did. I mean, are people not paying attention?
Well, look, there are a lot of people who are commuters. There are a lot of people who were led to believe that their very jobs and livelihood depended on him getting back into office.
I think that's the crux of it all. That's why he may have gotten so many votes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're going to be shown to be deficient at the end of the day. So how do you transition from the election process that you just finished, completed, and were at the top of the totem pole? How do you transition between now and the general election, and then from that eventually into taking office? What do you need to do?
Well, one of the things that was very encouraging is last night, mm-hmm. you know, quite a few city council members came by
right.
our celebration and gave their well wishes. We got calls from the county executive, and our deputy county executive came by this morning.
Right. Because
I'm a consensus mm-hmm. builder, and I'm focused on the future of Mount Vernon and
right.
not just celebrating from last night. I reached out and
mm-hmm.
spoke with Councilwoman Farquharson. I've received a reach
yeah.
out from our comptroller, Reynolds, already. I've left messages
Fantastic.
For both Andre and Clyde. So I'm not waiting for people to call me. I'm
mm-hmm.
reaching out to people. I'm reaching
that
out to
is
people.
Fantastic. That is very good. Also, though, when we recognize that so many people, top politicians and the party itself in Mount Vernon, Democratic powerhouses, all of them, they were backing up Eisley, and yet that failed. So that speaks very highly of your ability to resonate with the public. Much more so than any of the other candidates. And what do you feel, what do you think that was, what aspect of you, is it just your intellect, your experience, your good looks, how well you dress? I mean, you know, I don't know, it could go on forever, right? But it's all there, right? It's a package.
Well,
so how
you know,
how did you reach out to them?
You know, as I've stated in the past, especially I think our early conversations, people
right.
saw me being a social worker as being
okay.
a disadvantage. You know, people tried to kind of paint me as, oh, she's just a social worker. But being a social worker in Mount Vernon, I touched the lives of many families for many years.
Right.
and working at the YMCA, so whether it was my those people, not just the clients, but their family members that I touched in the AIDS
mm-hmm.
program or in the drug court, the incredible people
right.
that I met at the Mount Vernon YMCA who were adults, who were business people, but then also the young people. I was there from 2004 to 2008, so that's 15,
yeah.
you know, 10 to 15 years ago. A lot of those young
right.
people came to me over the past few months and said,
oh,
you know, Ms. Howard or Auntie, these are millennials
yeah.
and they're professionals, and
right.
so they were excited. So our reach was very, very different into the community because of those relationships and the work that we've done
mm-hmm.
that was not political. People knew me as a person and a person who cared
right.
about people and wanted to help people. But then also my last 15 years of leadership as an executive and a business person who sat at the business tables and decision-making tables, I was also
mm-hmm.
able to speak to the other segments of the community that wanted to make sure that we had a leader who could be fiscally responsible, who knew how to build
mm-hmm.
consensus, who understood the issues
yeah.
around infrastructure. So, you know, I think I had my hand in both areas, understanding the community and knowing what the community wanted and needed, but then also having the professional experience to speak to, you know, some of the other people in the community who might have been concerned that I was too much of a social worker and didn't understand business.
You know what's so interesting that you bring that up, and I mean, you triggered a thought that you may have said this to me before, but I think I dismissed it because it's like so ridiculous to even consider that, you know, it's a derogatory concept that here you are a social worker. you're just a people person, and you were concerned about people, and you did what you could with them and for them. I don't understand how that they thought that that would fly, but evidently, they just don't have a clue. So it is truly amazing, because I think actually, when I reflect on that, that may have been the extra ingredient that they overlooked, because they were trying to diminish you with it. But I think it's what exalted you to greater prominence. Because, they, like you said, you had that legacy of time with people, and they knew who you were. You
right.
can't hide, you know, when you live in a community. You can't hide. This is not New York City, where everybody doesn't – no one knows anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even know if you're on the same floor who's living there. This is Mount Vernon. You know, what
Mount
is it,
Vernon.
70,000 people.
Well, more like 100,000. More like 100,000. We do terribly on our census, and that's definitely something I want to focus on moving forward. But, you know, look, when I was the planning commissioner and the director of urban
right.
renewal, the one thing that I continuously said to people, I said the planning department focuses on building and expanding economic development and capital development, but the urban renewal
yeah.
agency focuses on people. So we can fix up
mm-hmm.
the city, but if we can build the city, but if we don't build the people, then the only thing that can destroy the capital development we do is a people disaster. And that's something that I feel, like I said, gave me the strategic advantage that I needed, because I understood the importance of both. A lot of people spoke just to economic development and capital development,
mm-hmm.
but they really did not speak to the people. And so when you ask what's Mount Vernon's greatest asset, you heard location, our train stations. And I felt our
mm-hmm.
greatest asset was the people, because Mount Vernon residents are bright, they're resilient, they have grit, we have resolve, and even if we come together and fight, we also know how to come together and work together as a community when we
right.
need to. And so that, I believe, makes the difference.
Well, that's interesting, too. You know, I heard about a month and a half ago in White Plains, they passed an ordinance so that instead of the HUD designation for how much you could earn to be able to get a subsidized housing or affordable housing, they even created a lower level, entry place, especially for people who were like police and fire, who weren't as may not be earning as much as others, to have an affordable housing structure, which is very interesting, and it seems to work, or something that they've adopted and it's worked in other places. Are those some of the things that people discuss, like in government, like you would be discussing? Not that it's a done deal, but how do you move things like this forward?
Well, definitely, having the right people at the table. And
right.
I know before the week is out, I'll be sitting down with our county executive. I'll be having conversations with our senators, looking at some of the policies that are coming down from the state, look at what we're
right.
doing on a countywide level. I'll be reaching out to our neighboring mayors to have those conversations and look at what they're doing in their communities. And so Mount Vernon doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. We have to really pay attention to what's been happening well in other communities, and then also learn from other communities' challenges and bumps in the road. And that's what I do. I seek best practices, and I also learn
mm-hmm.
from other people's challenges. We don't have to hit our head the same way over and over again
sure.
as we try and figure things out. There's oftentimes a roadmap, and while we might be a different community, we can still utilize other people's experience to make the proper decisions here in Mount Vernon. And it's not just my decision alone. I look forward to working with the council and
right.
the comptroller and the stakeholders here in Mount Vernon to figure out what's going to be best for our community.
Just one last question, because I don't want to belabor your time, and I appreciate you making the time. Just the fact that you're a woman, are there aspects of being a woman, an accomplished woman, does that give you like a sense of certainly a difference in your capacity to reach out to people? There's a nurturing aspect about a woman that's greater than that you'll find in a man, or there's just a different expression of it. But is Mount Vernon ready for a woman like you?
I think Mount Vernon is ready for a woman like me. I'm a businesswoman. Yes, I am a nurturer.
Uh-huh.
I am hard on the results, but fair with
yeah.
the people. So
mm-hmm.
I'm a strategic thinker, and I'm a systems-level leader, but I believe in partnerships,
yeah.
and I believe in working with people. And so as a woman, we come to the table oftentimes with a little less ego.
Mm-hmm.
Our agendas are clear. Is that we want to see
yeah.
the best thing for our community, but our egos are not as great. And so I'm not looking to double down just to prove my point, but at the same
mm-hmm.
time, as I put on my Facebook page the other day, tough girls wear pumps mm-hmm. and pearls. And so I'm not worried about sitting at the table with men and businessmen because that's
yeah.
something that I've done all my life, whether it's literally
right.
at the business table or the boardroom or working with gang uh-huh. intervention in the street. The thing that I've learned most is when you give people respect, you get respect.
They give it back.
And I think that's
right.
the biggest key is when you give people respect and you seek to understand what their needs are, they're much more respectful of who you are and willing to work with you. And I think that has been one of my keys to success. I'm not a pushover and I'm not naive, but I do understand
right.
people. And I do understand how to work with people, and I do understand how to work with people to get the results that we need for our community.
Absolutely. Well, I hope as you continue your travel up to January 1, that you'll consider coming back on the show on whatever works so that people can learn a little bit more about how you're progressing and your conduct. That'll be very compelling, I'm sure. So thank you again, and much success, and good luck, and congratulations. It's well deserved.
Thank you so much, Hezzy. Thank you for your support, and thank you for providing me with a platform to be able to share some of my thoughts and help people
my
to
pleasure.
Get to understand who I was as a candidate.
And
thank
it's good to have learned who you are. It's been
thank
fun.
You so much. I appreciate it. You've
take care.
You've been supportive from day one. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Be well. Today
be well.
We have
bye-bye.
It, folks, none other than Shawn Patterson Howard. She is, you could say she is the mayoral-elect because the city of Mount Vernon is predominantly a registered Democrats in the entire city. And so whoever won this particular election process, the primary, which she did very convincingly as far as I'm concerned, then she is the next mayor of the city of Mount Vernon. Very, very compelling story, and what a wonderful turnout at the end of the day. So I look forward to a lot of really exceptional thinking and capacity from her. She's probably the most intellectual and yet down-to-earth person that ran in this particular contest. No games. No ploys. Just she is who she is, and she's proud of it, and she should be, and that's where we are. So let's go and move on to another thing. We're going to quickly play for you what's going on at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be right back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Hezi Arison. Should you be interested in getting or reaching out to the Yonkers Tribune, you can give them a call at their number, which their office number, their cell number, their text number, and their voicemail number, which is 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. So let's see what's going on in our world. The U.S. Special Counsel Mueller is going to testify in public on the Russian probe. U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who issued a report in April on Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election, will testify in open session for two House committees on July 17. The panel's Democratic chairman said that on Tuesday. So Representative Gerald Nadler, chairman of the Judiciary Panel, and Representative Adam Schiff, the head of the Intelligence Panel, said in a joint statement that Mueller had agreed to testify after the two committees issued subpoenas on Tuesday. A representative for Mueller did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Mueller's report, released publicly in April, found Russia meddled in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and that Republican President Donald Trump's election campaign had multiple contacts with Russian officials. But the report found insufficient evidence to establish a criminal conspiracy between the campaign and Moscow. The report, which was partially redacted, also outlined instances in which Trump tried to interfere with Mueller's investigation, but declined to make a judgment on whether that amounted to obstruction of justice. Now, Attorney General William Barr said there was insufficient evidence in Mueller's report to conclude that Trump obstructed justice. Trump says the report was a complete exoneration from what he called a witch hunt mounted by Democrats frustrated by his election victory. But some Democrats have said that the president should be removed from office through impeachment proceedings because of Mueller's findings. Quote, Americans have demanded to hear directly from the special counsel so they can understand what he and his team examined, uncovered, and determined about Russia's attack on our democracy, the Trump campaign's acceptance and use of that help, and President Trump and his associates' obstruction of the investigation into that attack, Nadler and Schiff said in their statement. Now, Representative Doug Collins, the top Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, said in a statement, quote, I hope the special counsel's testimony marks an end to the political gamesmanship that judiciary Democrats have pursued at great cost to taxpayers. Schiff told MSNBC in an interview, quote, we never felt it was sufficient to rely simply on a written report for a 10-minute statement without the ability to follow up with questions. Mueller, in his first public comment since starting the investigation in May of 2017, said on May 29th that his probe was never going to end with criminal charges against Trump and indicated it was up to Congress to decide whether he should be impeached. If we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so, Mueller said. Now, we did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime, and that's the end of the quote. So, very, very interesting that this is what transpired, and this is very, very pertinent. Now, on another front, which is interesting, evidently, Palestinians must sign on to an investment program if they want peace, Kushner says. So it's called the Peace to Prosperity Workshop. The Trump administration launched a $50 billion economic formula for Israeli-Palestinian peace on Tuesday. That's today. Saying an investment program for the Palestinians was a precondition for ending the decades-old conflict. Sorry, that was yesterday. I'm getting so confused. I'm still on yesterday's time. So U.S. President Donald Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner opened a two-day international meeting in Bahrain to rally support for the blueprint, which has met broad disdain from Palestinians and others in the Arab world, although regional U.S. allies such as Saudi Arabia discreetly support it. Quote, we can turn this region from a victim of past conflicts into a model for commerce and advancement throughout the world, Kushner told the gathering, attended by the heads of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, whose Palestinian Authority exercises a limited self-rule in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, was scathing about its prospects. Quote, money is important. The economy is important. The political solution is more important, end quote. The political details of the peace plan, almost 2 years in the making, remain secret. Neither the Israeli nor Palestinian governments attended the curtain-raising event, while several Arab states stayed away or sent deputy ministers. The conference is taking place in Bahrain, home to the United States Navy's Fifth Fleet, amid high tension between Tehran on the one hand, and Washington and its Sunni Muslim allies, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates on the other, and all share a common foe with Israel and Shiite Iran. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a close Trump ally, said that Israel was open to the proposal. Washington will be hoping that wealthy Gulf Arab states show a concrete interest in the plan, which expects donor nations and investors to contribute $50 billion to the Palestinian territories, Jordan, Egypt, and Lebanon. To be clear, economic growth and prosperity for the Palestinian people are not possible without an enduring and fair political solution to the conflict, one that guarantees Israel's security and respects the dignity of the Palestinian people, Kushner said. However, today is not about political issues. We will get to those at the right time. It is not clear whether the Trump team plans to abandon the two-state solution, which involves creation of an independent Palestinian state living side by side with Israel. The United Nations and most countries back the two-state solution, which has underpinned every peace plan for decades, but Trump's team has consistently refused to commit to it. Kushner told Al Jazeera TV on Monday that the Trump plan would not follow a Saudi-led Arab initiative that has been the Arab consensus on the outline of a settlement since 2002. Any solution must settle long-standing issues such as the status of Jerusalem, mutually agreed borders, Israel's security concerns, Palestinian demands for statehood, and the fate of Israel's settlement and military presence in territory where Palestinians want to build that state. Now, the Saudi-backed initiative calls for a Palestinian state with borders that predate Israel's capture of territory in the 1967 Middle East War, as well as a capital in East Jerusalem and refugees' right to return, all rejected by Israel. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat said that Kushner was, quote, committed to the initiatives of Israel's colonial settlement councils, end quote. On the outskirts of Ramallah, in the West Bank, Palestinian lawmaker Mustafa Barghouti said there could be, quote, no economic solution as a substitute for our freedom, end quote. A small crowd of protesters was dispersed by Israeli troops firing tear gas. Now, in Gaza, a business has closed doors in a general strike called by the ruling Islamist Hamas group and other factions. An Iranian official called Kushner's plan, quote, shameful, end quote, and, quote, doomed to failure, end quote. Trump on Monday imposed sanctions on Iran's supreme leader and other officials after Iran downed a U.S. drone following attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf. Palestinian leaders boycotted the conference and are refusing to engage with the White House, accusing it of pro-Israel bias. Breaking with the international consensus, Trump in 2017 recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, infuriating the Palestinians and other Arabs. However, Palestinian and Israeli businessmen, are attending, as are some Gulf and U.S. companies, including Blackstone Group, whose chief executive, Stephen Schwartzman, said Kushner's economic plan was, quote, not unachievable, end quote. Emirati billionaire Mohammed Al-Abar said that Arabs like him were ready to invest. This is a very sensible kind of dream, and one would have hoped the beneficiaries would have been here, he said. Chaim Taib, Israeli president of British-based Mitreli, an infrastructure development firm, said the plan seemed doable, but it was unclear how momentum would be maintained beyond the event. More than half of the $50 billion would be spent in the Palestinian territories over 10 years. The rest would be divided between Lebanon, Egypt, and Jordan, the country that has absorbed more Palestinians than any other, and fears anything that might lead to their permanent settlement there. A Palestinian businessman attending expressed disappointment that Kushner had not done more to address the political situation. Jared is not a politician. He's a real estate man. The businessman said on condition of anonymity, but he can't make economic peace only or political peace only. You have to do them both at the same time. So very, very compelling perspective. That's for sure. Now, let me quickly look at some other concerns. And this is going to be very interesting because we're talking about Canada's legal cannabis market. And it's a supply and demand operation. And I think you might want to hear this. It was back in October of 2018 that Canada became the first G7 country to legalize recreational cannabis. When Justin Trudeau's government made the move, one of its main objectives was to remove the lucrative cannabis market from the hands of illegal dealers and organized crime. State-run dispensaries have since been put in place, yet the black market remains well and truly alive in a country where one in five inhabitants claim to have used cannabis in one form or another this past year. And so the correspondent from Agence France-Presse reports this. So the program was prepared by Patrick Lovett, Rebecca Martin, and James Messina. So listening to this report. Bear with me.
It may seem like any other phone number in Montreal. This one circulates among university students.
Hello. Hello, oui, bonsoir.
Good evening.
Ça va bien?
How's it going?
Ouais. Je voulais voir
I want to know if you could swim by the house anytime soon. And you asked for the address?
C'est bon, une trentaine de
minutes. Okay, in about 30 minutes.
Okay.
See you in a few, I'll call you back.
Merci, à tantôt.
Thanks, see you in a few.
We just ordered cannabis from an illegal vendor. 12 minutes later, the salesman is already here.
Okay.
What's up?
We filmed
all
the transaction with a hidden camera.
So it's 25 Canadian, right?
In this black bag, there are dozens of labeled bags.
I've got L.A. Amnesia, Super Jack. I don't know. You've got a big selection. What would you recommend? Amnesia is good. Thank you. That's
it's an
perfect
example of the trafficking the Canadian government is trying to eradicate by legalizing recreational cannabis this past October 17. In the province of Quebec, cannabis sales are under the control of the state, but the black market captures most of the demand, 80% of sales according to official numbers. Authorities are gaining ground, they're usually out of stock, but their prices are higher than the black market. They've actually increased in the past month.
It's around 30% more expensive when you buy it in the shop. But coming here is more convenient. It's simpler. And that's what makes the real difference.
One thing I will give them is that they seem very knowledgeable and helpful and enthusiastic to try and get you the right stuff, yeah.
I just don't have it all the time.
Don't have it. Yeah, that's the big problem.
The Quebec Society of Cannabis, who is often criticized, declined our request for comment. We took these images the night before its opening last October. No camera is authorized in stores. In the open war against the black market, the state depends on its suppliers to produce more and faster. Ontario is Canada's most populated province and the country's second largest consumer. In this old chocolate factory, the world's leader in cannabis set up a gigantic lab garden.
Construction here is ever-present. These are all our mother plants. These are the plants from which we take all the clones that will eventually be flowered and grown out.
Machines here run at full capacity. Safety and sanitary operations involving packaging are costly, which explains the price difference between the legal and illegal market.
The recreational product packaging, so it comes in square containers, medical tweed, and then medical for our soft shells. So we produce in different formats. We produce in oils, which we then can turn into soft shells. We do pre-roll joints, and then this, of course, is just what it all starts with. The goal.
Production here has boomed. In a few months, the multinational went from occupying 3 to 41 hectares to supply sales points in the following months. Canopy is already in negotiations with Europe to potentially supply its 700 million people, although it's mostly legal for medical use only.
We're present in Germany, we're present in Poland, Czech Republic, United Kingdom, and each country is looking at this in different ways, and I think, you know, that conversation is good. There's a ton of things going on the medical cannabis side, on clinical research, on developing new and novel products and opening new markets. So I think, I hope that many of your viewers will see us available in their countries in the months and years to come.
In Toronto, 6 months after legalization, only 2 stores have opened. According to official accounts, legal cannabis has only attracted 4% new consumers. However, the green gold rush has begun in stock markets. Investments are projected to go from $500 million last year to $5 to $10 billion in 2025, thanks not only to smokers.
The next generation of products are going to come to market, so vaporizer pens, beverages, chocolate bars, edibles, concentrates. These types of products are really key in markets if you look like it to California, where companies are really able to build really unique and visible brands. And once this next phase of legalization hits in Canada, I think you're going to start to see the sector even have more of an uptick. And in fact, certainly leading into this timeline in October 2019, I think the market's likely only going to get hotter in very specific areas.
As for public and road safety, police say it's too early to judge what kind of impact legalization has had. Special units have been formed to screen drivers. For now, though, no rise in crimes or offenses tied to cannabis.
Well, that's the story there. Very, very interesting, to say the least. Now, let's quickly look and see what else is going on around the world so we can catch up. 1 second. And this is just some more stuff about what's going on with the United Nations effort. It seems that donors have pledged $110 million for the UN Palestinian Agency shunned by the United States. So $110 million was raised today, or rather yesterday, at a pledge conference to support the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, United Nations Refugee, I don't know what the RW, it's a UNRWA, which has been struggling since the United States slashed funding. So the chief of the UNRWA, his name is Pierre Kahn-Boul, said that the funding would allow the agency, which provides education and health services to Palestinians, to cover costs for the coming months and avoid a budget crisis. So around 35 countries took part in the conference, mostly European and Arab nations, with the biggest contributions coming from the European Union, Germany, and Britain. The conference was held on the same day as President Donald Trump's administration unveiled the economic component of a long-awaited Middle East peace plan at a workshop in Bahrain boycotted by the Palestinian Authority. So the U.S. plan dangles the prospect of $50 billion of investment in the Palestinian territory and neighboring Arab countries. So that's the story. So we'll see what goes on there. That's like the latest update. And 1 second. And this is also a recent Palestinian leadership should sign on to the U.S. Economic Development Plan and worry about their political status later. That's what Hebrew University of Jerusalem historian Gadi Taub told Franz Van Katz. So listen into this interview. One second. One moment. Okay.
It's a shame that they're thinking it. I had a radio interview with a Palestinian colleague, and I told him, look, if it was Zionism, we would have taken the money, built stuff with it, and then tried to move on to other goals, not give it up in advance. And I think they're not completely honest about it, because in our world of moral kitsch, where victimhood is moral justification for everything, I think the one asset the Palestinians are not willing to give up is their misery. And so they have a leadership that's keeping them at the state of a perpetual victimhood, and it's a shame.
You mentioned Zionism. What if the British had said at the time to David Ben-Gurion, we'll give you millions of dollars of investment, but you're not going to have a state? It wouldn't have gone down well. The Jews dreamed of having a state.
Ben-Gurion would have taken the money and then demanded a state. Of course he would. First of all, and there was, you know, there was a Palestinian leader with a vision, Salam Fayyad, who said, let's first build the economy. Because under this state of perpetual misery, your national movement cannot take off. So why not first resurrect the Palestinian economy? I don't get it. Why don't you first take the money?
What has changed this time around, and what must be seen positively in Israel, I guess, is that so many Arab countries are participating in this summit in Bahrain. You've got the UAE, you've got Saudi Arabia, you've also got Egypt and Jordan sending delegations. That would have been unthinkable a short while ago, wouldn't it?
Yeah, this is amazing. I think there is change. This is one of the strange repercussions of the Obama years, which were very traumatic to all of the U.S. allies. And what they did is they scrambled for some sort of cooperation. And so new avenues open up between Israel and the Sunni countries, because we are all afraid of Iran. Look, if Iran ever gets the bomb, there is a lot of money in the Middle East. There would be a nuclear arms race with rogue regimes.
We'll get to Iran in a moment, but I want to talk a bit more about the Palestinians and about the situation they're in now. You have in the past made a very controversial claim, and that is that the Palestinian leadership is not actually interested in ending the occupation of the West Bank. That seems very dismissive of their long struggle for statehood. Elaborate.
The struggle is not for statehood. It is for the right of return. They have rejected suggestion for a deal, including ones that were clearly in their favor, including the one suggested by Obama and John Kerry, including the one that went beyond what the Israeli public would agree to by Ehud Olmert, and they have always rejected it, always, because they are not aiming for independence, they are aiming for the right of return, that is, the return of the descendants of the refugees of the 48 war into Israel itself. They are against the two-state solution. The current Fatah leadership saw what happened to the Fatah leadership in Gaza. And so people don't understand that the Israeli occupation is the only thing protecting the PA from Hamas.
Nevertheless, it's not sustainable, is it, to continue with the occupation? It is corrosive to the state of Israel. It is terrible for the Palestinians not to have a state, not to have the same rights as every other citizen on earth. It can't continue, can it?
I hear you. Why don't we all convince the Palestinians? Because they've been rejecting it. We are forced. Look, we have even tried unilateral. What did we get from Gaza? Rockets. We can't have rockets from Samaria. People don't realize Israel is 9 miles wide. Samaria is overlooking the center of Israel and our only international airport. We can't have a Hamas regime overlooking my house, for instance.
Let's talk about Donald Trump. You know, he's not the neutral broker between Israel and the Palestinians, is he, by any stretch of the imagination? He has been described as one of the most pro-Israel U.S. presidents in history. He moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. He recognized the Golan Heights. He cut off funding to UNRWA, the Palestinian Refugee Agency. That might be good in the short term, particularly for Benjamin Netanyahu, but in the long term, isn't that damaging for Israel? Doesn't that just make peace with the Palestinians even more difficult?
First of all, I think Trump himself is a businessman and very pragmatic. I don't think he will stick by Israel if Israel will be the refusing part. The things he did, we forget, the moving of the embassy in Jerusalem was not into East Jerusalem. It does not contradict the idea of partitioning the city at all. But what he did, and I think is extremely refreshing, the Palestinians have been conditioned to the idea that every time they refuse a deal, they get a better one. Now there's a president who said, every time you refuse, you'll get a worse one. So come to the table and compromise.
Another Trump policy, as I mentioned, was to cut off aid to the Palestinians. I mean, aside from causing humanitarian hardship to the poorest Palestinians, this also causes problems for Israel in terms of security cooperation, doesn't it?
Well, first of all, if he's going to broker $50 billion for them, and you know, this is five times more than what it took to reconstruct Japan after World War II. If they stop sinking the money into terror tunnels and corruption, they can have Singapore in Gaza. That's one thing. Secondly, he cut funding for UNRWA. UNRWA is one of the obstacles to peace. UNRWA is the authority that perpetuates, that refuses any resettlements of refugees because it holds the refugees hostages in its plan to destroy Israel, to bring them to Israel. So long as UNRWA is supported, we have an obstacle to peace, not a bridge to peace.
Of course, the political part of the Bahrain plan has had to be delayed because of the political situation in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu narrowly won the election, then he failed to form a government. Is his political survival becoming more important than peace and security for Israelis?
I don't know that there is anyone with a plan for peace and security, since the Palestinians are the reluctant part, the recalcitrant part that won't allow us to move. In these terms, Netanyahu is probably against the Trump peace plan, but it doesn't matter because there is no partner for it. So Israel might as well say yes.
Finally, a word on Iran. As you know, tensions are escalating rapidly at the moment. There are fears of a military confrontation between the United States and Iran. Is the U.S. going to war for Benjamin Netanyahu? He, after all, has been the one calling for the U.S. to quit the nuclear deal. He's consistently done so, even when the Israeli intelligence community was saying that the deal was actually the best way to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions. Americans will not forgive Israel if it drags America into another Middle Eastern war.
I don't think the reason for the war would be Israel. I think preventing a nuclear arms race, Iran is far more dangerous than North Korea, far more dangerous, far smarter, far stronger. And we have Turkey and we have Saudi Arabia. We have countries around it with a lot of money and nuclear ambitions. I think it's an American interest, but you're absolutely right. The one thing Israel can't afford is dragging Americans into a war they don't want for our sakes. Usually, we take the money and send our boys.
Danny Taub there speaking to me earlier.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. We'll see what else is going on. There's a lot of stuff around the world. Amazing. So I hope that was an informative interview for you. And this is really quite exciting because I didn't think this would happen, but it is. Evidently, San Francisco has banned the sale of e-cigarettes. And this is another report, which I think you'll find interesting. So lawmakers in San Francisco have voted to ban the sale and manufacture of e-cigarettes in the city, despite being home to the market leader in the industry. So the vote came as authorities voiced concern over the rise of young people vaping. Also today, we look at a new report on the effects of increased automation it's having on jobs in the manufacturing sector. So I think we'll just end up doing the vaping things first, so bear with me.
The heart and soul of every business or home is the furniture inside.
Okay, bear with me a moment. Okay. Here we are.
Turn out for a look at the latest business news, and we're going to start with news that San Francisco is set to become the first U.S. city to ban the sale of e-cigarettes. To tell us more, our business editor Stephen Carr is here with all the details. Stephen.
The city's lawmakers voted unanimously to ban the sale and manufacture of electronic cigarettes. The mayor now needs to sign that ordinance to bring it into effect. San Francisco is home to the market leader in this industry, a company called Juul. E-cigarettes are a fast-growing business. Sales in the United States worth some $3.6 billion in 2018, according to research from Mordor Intelligence. Federal regulators in the U.S. have given manufacturers until 2021 to evaluate the harmful effects of their products, but lawmakers in San Francisco say that's too long. Peter O'Brien reports.
Juul no more. San Francisco has banned the sale and manufacture of e-cigarettes. It's the first major U.S. city to do so, responding to fears that vaping might be harmful.
I will introduce a resolution.
When the order was first voted on, San Francisco legislators pointed out that the ban would be lifted if the Food and Drug Administration approved such products.
Companies like Juul have had 3 years to submit their product and marketing to the FDA. The question is, why haven't they? And the answer is because they want to protect their profits to continue targeting and harming our young people, and they know nicotine is not healthy.
Juul, founded in San Francisco 2 years ago, is now the most popular e-cigarette in the U.S. It accounts for more than two-thirds of the market share, with sales expected to top $3 billion this year. It's the main culprit for the ban supporters, who claim such companies are targeting young people. The number of U.S. school students using e-cigarettes grew by 78% last year. The potential health consequences of vaping remain unclear, but include worries it could stunt adolescent development. Critics of the legislation say it will drive people back to regular cigarettes, which are known to cause cancer.
A new report says that automation will replace 20 million jobs in the manufacturing sector globally over the next decade. The Oxford Economic Study confirms a trend already underway, but also shows that the cost of robots is falling, making them cheaper than human workers in more cases. The effects of automation, the report says, are being more keenly felt in parts of the world where incomes are lower. Now, the Oxford Economic Study found that 8.5% of the global manufacturing workforce will be affected by 2030. Each new robot being introduced into manufacturing is replacing, on average, 1.6 jobs, and already 1.7 million people have been affected by this. That number set to rise sharply.
All right.
Moving on, China has banned all meat imports from Canada after finding a banned additive in a batch of pork. It follows an investigation that uncovered over 180 counterfeit veterinary health documents attached to meat exports. Chinese customs officials also found traces of the feed additive, which is...
Okay, bear with me a moment. So I just lost that page. Hold on a moment. Well, we're just going to move on. But that's going to be very interesting what's happening there. We'll find out how that works. And I think that that's about it. I don't think we have anything else to cover with you today. This is lastly the most interesting thing. That is with the cyber attack that the U.S. engaged on Iran is shrouded in digital fog of war. So it seems that a claim by U.S. officials that a retaliatory cyber attack ordered by the White House crippled Iranian missile launching systems will remain almost impossible to substantiate, experts say. And citing unnamed sources, U.S. media reported last week that the attack launched by the U.S. Cyber Command disabled computers of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard unit responsible for shooting down an American surveillance drone over the Strait of Hormuz on June 20. But Tehran denied the report, saying no successful attack has been carried out by the United States against the Islamic Republic. And yet all sides are bluffing. Julien Nocetti, of the French Institute of International Relations, said all sides bluff in such cases. You must not reveal your play, he told Agence France-Presse. It's an extremely subtle game of cat and mouse. It is not surprising the Iranians claim the cyber attack failed, and we have no way of verifying the statements of either side, he added. When it comes to cyber conflict, the fog of war, as military theorist Karl von Clausewitz had called it, is as thick as ever. There are no fighting fronts or observers, and evidence and clues can be easily manipulated when the confrontation plays out within computer servers. The fact that the United States chose or were instructed to quickly leak news about the illegal cyber attack points to a desire by President Donald Trump's administration to prove it did not stand by idly. Even after calling off a military strike against Tehran, that's what experts are saying. According to Nicholas Alpazian, a cybersecurity critic expert, the reality of the attack and its exact objectives and effectiveness will remain a mystery. In this case, Iranian military targets were chosen. If they had been civilian targets, it would have been different. If power plants were targeted, then power would have been cut off. If it were a water company, then people would have lined up to get bottles of water. Arpagian said only the Iranians would know the scope of the damage from a cyber attack, while destruction from missiles would easily be measured. The digital weapons allow President Trump to show the world, and especially his supporters, that he is responding to Iran, he added. But the fact that the targets are military means only the Iranians would tell or could tell if they suffered any damage, which they will, of course, not do. So on Monday, Iran's telecommunications minister, Mohammad Javad Azari Yahromi, declared or acknowledged that Tehran has been facing cyber terrorism such as Stuxnet and unilateralism such as sanctions, but said, quote, no successful attack has been carried out by them, although they are making a lot of effort, end quote. The Stuxnet virus discovered in 2010 is believed to have been engineered by Israel and the United States to damage nuclear facilities in Iran. Iran at the same time accused the United States and Israel of using the virus to target centrifuges for uranium enrichment. Loic Guezzo of the French Information Security Club said such cyber attacks show that the U.S., quote, has the resources and technical capabilities to neutralize an enemy's system. It is the establishment of a balance of power, the equivalent of, in wars, of the future of a parade in Russia, Red Square, with hundreds of nuclear weapons. So tensions between Iran and the United States have been high since Trump last year unilaterally drew from the landmark 2015 nuclear deal signed between Tehran and world powers. Now, the accord sought to curb Iran's nuclear ambitions in exchange for sanctions relief, but they spiked in recent weeks from Washington accused Tehran of being behind a series of attacks on tankers in sensitive Gulf waters. Iran has denied any involvement. Now, for Nechetti, the cyber attack is not only a message for the Iranians, but for other countries as well. It's a message for the rest of the world. Moscow and Beijing will be watching closely, he said. So those are the situations that exist. All right, so let me move back to our studio screen, and we are fine. Let me quickly look to see what we have scheduled for tomorrow. Tomorrow is Thursday. I know we're going to have Lori and John Wiles. I don't know what vehicles we're covering tomorrow, but we'll find out, and then we'll post it for you. So all the best, and thank you. Thank you again. Goodbye. Let me go back to our studio screen. Bear with me. Okay, here we are. Thanks again. Goodbye.